I would ask you, if you would, to return with me to the book of Jude. Jude 11 this morning. This letter is very difficult. I suspect that the average American attempting to read the letter of Jude probably doesn't really know what it means. And there's a number of reasons for that. We've already mentioned a couple of them. The fact, number one, that Jude uses language that is both difficult to interpret into English or translate into English, as well as language that is obsolete in many ways. That, remember that phrase, relying on their imaginations. Big 14-letter Greek word doesn't get used very often in Scripture, and it's a difficult word to translate into English. But not only that, when we do find words in this book that we are at least quote-unquote familiar with, a lot of the terminology itself has disappeared from the lexicon of American Christianity. We looked at the word last week, blasphemy. How many people use the word blasphemy anymore? It's not a word that's used very much. In fact, if you ask the typical Christian, what is blasphemy? They'll probably say something like, well, it's kind of like Jesus claiming to be God, right? That's blasphemy. Well, that's true, but it's not the entire meaning of the word in terms of its real lexical use. It's the idea, instead, rather, of belittling something that deserves our honor, or taking for granted something that's more powerful than us that we're not thinking about might be an issue, as Jude himself says, that we need to be, that these false teachers are blaspheming the glorious ones. That's a deep concept to understand. This book's difficult because it's got words in it that are hard to understand. But there's another reason why it's difficult. It's difficult because Jude uses some examples even that are obscure. Obscure examples that would be even obscure to his own audience. Barely known or recognizable in their day, much less in ours. And even filled with mythology, if they are understood. If you look at verse 11, you will notice that Jude makes reference to three individuals, Cain, Balaam, and Korah. And I imagine if I took a poll amongst a typical Baptist church and asked them, who are these three men? Most would probably say, well, Cain is that guy that killed his brother, right? Back early in the book of Genesis. And then I ask about Balaam and they go, well, I vaguely remember something about Balaam's donkey. I think he was the one that was able to speak, wasn't he? But other than that, I have no idea who the guy is. And if I asked them who Korah was and what Korah's rebellion is, they would look at me like I'd just grown a horn out of the middle of my forehead. I had no idea who you're talking about. Okay, you'll notice how obscure these examples are. They're very strange. And not only that, but a lot of the biblical stories that we relate wind up growing a certain amount of mythology around them, sort of like a moss growing on the north side of a tree. These stories get a bit of mythology over time. Probably the greatest example that we have is the story of Noah and his flood. There's massive mythology around that story. Even Bill Cosby did a routine years ago on Noah, which I still find humorous. The fact is that it's grown up a certain mythology, right? The story is that Noah was told to build an ark and bring two of all the animals on board the ark, and then when he got out of the ark, life went back on again. But the mythology is that he brought two of each animal. He did not. If you read the story carefully, he brought seven, or at least seven pairs, in some cases, of animals on board the ark, depending on whether they were clean or unclean. Because what most people don't remember in the story is that when Noah got off the ark, he built an altar immediately and began to sacrifice some of the animals. Well, if he only brought two sheep on board, one male, one female, and he killed one of them, there ain't going to be any more sheep left on the planet, right? See the mythology that grows up. Sometimes we think we know these stories, but when we really dig into the details of them, we probably do not. So I think we're going to need to do in verse 11 what we did in verses 5, 6, and 7. And that is, we're going to need to examine very carefully the details of each story so that we can make the connection that Jude is assuming as he's making a connection to the false teachers that he's accusing in this book. Very much like we needed to do when we talked about Sodom and Gomorrah back in verse 7. We need to do the same in this case. Now, let me put this into context for you again of where we're at. You remember that verse 8 is the thesis part 2. It attempts to address the second part of verse 4, in which Jude speaks about the fact that these are people who pervert the grace of God into sensuality. Verses 5 to 7 deals with the first part of that, who long ago were designated for condemnation. So now he's working on the second part of his thesis. And so this second part, which comes up again in verse 8, reads like this. Those who come to pervert the grace of God in the gospel start from a basis of emotionalism rather than an objective standard of truth, and they ignore or deny the grave danger that they put themselves and their followers in. That's where he's going. Back to verse 8, 9, and 10. Those who blaspheme the glorious ones are belittling the evil spiritual realm by failing to grasp the danger of being manipulated by it. As I've said, those who are driven by emotion are easy prey for manipulation. And so he's expressing this reality. He continues his thesis now in verse 11 by speaking more specifically of the danger the false teachers bring upon themselves and their audience. The three examples we have in verse 11 are three examples of danger that came upon men before and now also come upon the false teachers. But before we get to the examples, let's just look at the first two words of verse 11. Now, you might say it's three, but it's really only two in the Greek. There's two Greek words underlying the phrase in verse 11 that begins, woe to them. The first of these two words is a word that is translated aoi. I love it. I love that. And the reason why is because the word is known as an interjection. An interjection. It's an interjection as a particle. It's a simple word that can stand alone all by itself. You can write it down. It becomes a whole sentence just by itself. And its whole purpose is to express a particular emotion. To express an emotion. In the olden days, we might write something like, alas, or phew, or the horror, or gasp, and put an exclamation point behind each of those words in our writings. Now, we don't do that in modern days. What we do in modern days is we use something called emojis. Okay? That's an interjection. All right, it's a little thing, not a word, it's just a picture, but what's it designed to convey? It's designed to convey emotion, right? You put three little spinning heads laughing themselves silly to express the fact that you're laughing yourself silly. You know, it used to be LOL, but now we use emojis, right? It's an interjection. Jude stops to interject an emotion here. But the emotion is followed then by a pronoun. It's followed by a pronoun. In this case, a plural personal pronoun. Them. Okay, would be the best way to translate it. It's not singular, he or she. It's plural, them. And because it's in the dative form, it means something that happens to them. So most translations use either to them or unto them. Same word, right? So it's a particular someone upon which an action is being performed. So if you put the two words together, aoi, autos, you wind up with this idea of woe to them. It is an expression of danger. It is an expression of danger. It is exactly where I've been getting my thesis all along, that Jude believes these people are putting themselves in danger. He expresses it directly. Woe to them. There is danger coming in them. Every English Bible, by the way, translates it that way. Woe unto them. He's warning them of something that is coming upon them. It's exactly what Jesus did in Matthew 23 when he said to the Pharisees, woe to you, you whitewashed tombs, you hypocrites. There is danger coming to you. You don't see it. That's what he meant. It's exactly the same thing. It's an expression by Jude of the realization of what he had just written about. He writes about these people blaspheming the glorious ones, about how even Michael didn't pretend to take Satan for granted. And these people continue to do these things, not realizing they're being manipulated by the evil spiritual realm. And it's almost as though he has to stop and write, woe to them. This is dangerous. They don't understand what they're flaunting here. The horror of seeing people flaunt the danger of being manipulated by evil. Jude knows that the false teachers are in grave danger, and they put their followers in the same danger. And as I said a moment ago, the three names to follow are simply examples of that danger. Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. They walked in the way of Cain. In order to understand that story, the story of Cain and Abel, you must understand first the story of the chapter immediately preceding it. That would be Genesis 3. In fact, Genesis chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel, is nothing more than the outcome of Genesis chapter 3. In fact, the parallels between them are so significant, you may not have ever really even noticed them. You don't get Genesis 4 without Genesis 3. The natural results of the fall occur in Genesis 4. So let's spend a little time in Genesis 3. A little time here, just a little. You know the story of Genesis 3, right? Adam and Eve are placed in the garden after they are formed from the dust of the ground, Eve being formed from the rib of the man. And they are placed into this Edenic world to enjoy the presence of God in a relationship with him when Satan comes slithering into the garden in the form of a serpent. And he tempts the woman to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the forbidden fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And she does. She eats from the tree. And when she does so, she immediately discovers, along with her husband, that she is naked. She immediately discovers that she is outwardly uncovered, and their nakedness becomes a shame over them. You remember, when God had formed him from the dust of the ground and her from him, he had made them outwardly perfect, in the sense that their bodies were now not a thing of shame, but a thing of glory, because I'm convinced that the second person of the Trinity had come down from his place at the Father's right hand and had taken dust from the ground and formed it intimately and lovingly into precisely what he wanted it to look like. There was no shame in that, because the Son of God himself had formed the very nature of them. But now, because of sin, because of what they have done, they look upon their outward nature, and they are ashamed of what they see. They now begin to cover their private parts, which were not private prior to that. They didn't need to be. There was no shame involved in being naked. Every aspect of the imago Dei in them was corrupted by the fall, including even their vision of what they looked like prior to this. And so they try to cover themselves using plant material. They take leaves from fig trees and they try to sew them together in order to produce outward garments to cover their nakedness, to cover the shame over themselves. I've never found a single evolutionist anywhere that's ever been able to explain to me why human beings instinctively cover themselves with clothing. And when I say instinctively, I mean it's almost as though we just automatically do this, right? We do so because Adam and Eve felt this tremendous shame that their physical natures no longer represented the perfect righteousness and intimate loving creation that God had made, and they were filled with guilt and shame. God then comes into the garden, as he did every day, And upon their confession of having eaten from the tree, he then levels his curses against each of the players in this little melodrama. He curses Satan, the serpent, to be in constant conflict with the human species, unable to subdue humanity to his will, that Satan would not enjoy victory over humanity, but would be constantly in conflict with this creature. He will literally eat dust as he crawls upon the ground under the heel of man, never quite able to overcome him and destroy him, especially the seed of the woman who would come to destroy him. God turns his attention then to Eve, and he curses her in giving to her pain and suffering in the one thing she was formed to do, which was to bring forth children. Adam, you remember, had no such ability. And when it was discovered that none of the animals of the field could help him with this task of taking dominion over the world by being fruitful and multiply, God formed from him a creature like him, yet distinct from him and different, which would be purposely for bringing forth children from the world. But God now curses the one thing that she was given this great priority to do. Not the only thing she could do, but the one thing that she would have great priority of doing that man could never do, contrary to what we're being told by National Geographic today. She was formed to multiply, to bring forth children. But God curses that act. Now she would bring forth her children in great pain and suffering. And then finally, God turns his attention to the man and he curses Adam. And he curses Adam to scratch and claw and toil and sweat to bring forth food from the ground. Until now, the earth had willingly yielded its crops so that man would enjoy every imaginable kind of food in great plenty. But now, because of the curse, Adam will have to toil the ground. He will have to toil it. He will have to seed it. He will have to water it. He will protect it. It will bring forth weeds and thistles and thorns. And he will have to scratch and toil and work to just try to survive. And when he works, he will work the ground to try to survive, and he will work, and he will sweat, and he will toil, and it will drive him back into the very dust he came from. He will literally work himself back into the very ground from which he came. He will no longer find the earth willingly bringing forth food. He would now do a toil that would send him back to the ground from whence he came, a toil of death. God levels these curses upon the human race for what Adam and Eve and the serpent have done. But in response to his own curses, God will issue forth two great acts of mercy upon the man and the woman. First, he will remove their fig leaf clothing and he will replace it with skins taken from an animal. I am convinced again, and you will not unconvince me of this, but I am convinced that this is again the second person of the Trinity, stepping down from his Father's right hand to enter again into the world that he had created, to take and kill a lamb. Yes, I am convinced it is a lamb. Makes perfect sense that it would be. Takes a lamb and kills the lamb in front of Adam and Eve. Removes the skins from the animals and places those skins upon Adam and Eve. That Adam and Eve would watch and hear as the Lord himself would kill for the first time something, drain its blood, take its skin, and place it upon them. The one who would eventually be the Lamb of God himself kills a sheep in their sight to give them life. He imputes the life of the creature he has killed unto Adam and Eve. Because you see, Adam and Eve were told, the day you eat from the tree, you shall surely die. When Eve ate from that tree, when Adam ate behind her, they should have fallen over to the dust of the ground dead, because that is what God said would happen. But now God in his mercy says, no, I will allow you to continue to live. I will impute the life of the sheep that I have just killed to you. I will clothe your nakedness with the life of the animal, that you might also live on. And then the second act of mercy is he banishes them from Eden. He sends them away from the garden. He prevents them from having access to the tree of life. And this is an act of mercy, because God says, I will not allow you in your corrupted, shameful, guilty sense to live on forever by eating from the tree. I will give you the mercy of death in anticipation of one day when I will raise your bodies from the dust of the ground and make you more glorious even than you were prior to the fall. It is an act of mercy for God to allow them no access to the tree of life, to live forever in their corrupted nature. I don't know about you, but I don't want to live forever in this broken down body. I can't imagine what it would be like to try to live in this body for 900 years. I mean, at 60, look at me. And so he drives them from the garden in anticipation of a new day. Now that's the context that sits before Genesis chapter 4. It is all of that which makes Genesis chapter 4 real. So would you turn with me to the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis, and let's examine this chapter. And what we're going to do this morning is we're going to go through it, verse by verse, and see what it says. Genesis chapter 4, verse 1 says, now Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. The name Cain literally means gotten. And verse 2, and again she bore his brother Abel. Now let me just pause there for a moment and note something. Adam and Eve begin to multiply, as they were commanded to do, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And so now they begin to do so. But I'll have you notice that this verse really doesn't tell us much about the multiplication of Adam and Eve. All right? This verse tells us nothing except that Cain was the older brother. It does not tell us anything about the other children of Adam and Eve, because obviously they must have had other children. I mean, after all, if the biblical account of Adam and Eve multiplying is limited to Cain and Abel and Seth, the human race didn't make it very far. Why not? No women. And you got to have girls to make babies. Again, I understand I'm not being very modern when I say that. But the fact is that there were undoubtedly other children born to Adam and Eve, many. We also don't know from this verse when Cain and Abel were born in terms of the relationship of them to the fall. Were they born before the fall or after the fall? We like to read this verse in this chronological sense of saying, well, after the fall, then this is what happens. But the verse doesn't actually say that if you read it carefully. All this verse tells us is that there were two sons born to Adam and Eve, which become the characters of the story here. There are obviously many others. It then says, Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain a worker of the ground. Now again, let me pause. Here we have the two men's profession outline. They begin to work. Human beings began to work. Cain works the ground as a farmer, and Abel is a keeper of sheep. Now, let me just correct something here. This is one of those mythologies that I think grows into this text a little bit, and that is that because we know the outcome of this story, because we know how it ends, we have a tendency to think that Cain being a farmer is a bad thing. But it's not. Quite the contrary, in fact. We like to think of Cain's job as a farmer as being somewhat ignoble and that it's somewhat wrong. But I would argue that Cain is following in his father's footsteps. It seems likely, based on what God said to Adam, that Adam would have also been a farmer. And so Cain, I think, is following in the footsteps of his father in doing the noble task of toiling the ground to bring forth the food that would be necessary to support his family. That's a noble task. It's a noble task to go out and plant crops and harvest them and bring them to market and feed people with them. That's a noble task. Some of the most noble men that I've ever met are farmers. I mean, you want to talk about people with patience. Farming is a noble task. We must not automatically assume that Cain is being condemned here because he's scratching and clawing at the ground. That's not at all the intention. Okay, so let's not read that into it. Let me also note something else. Again, some mythology. The work of Abel in keeping flocks was not for the purpose of food. These sheep were not being eaten by humans. In fact, the consumption of animals, if you remember the flow of the book of Genesis, does not begin until after the flood. It is only then that God says, I now give you all of the creatures that you may eat. And it's only then, after the flood, that human beings become carnivores. In fact, all the creatures of the earth prior to the flood appear to be just herbivores, eating plants, toiling the ground, bringing forth fruit, bringing forth food, and eating it. The consumption of animals was not put in place until after the flood. The animals that were being kept by Abel were probably being kept for another reason. Sure, they may have drank their milk and used their wool and that sort of thing, but they weren't consuming the sheep. And if you look carefully also at Genesis 9, where it speaks of these things, it is at that point that God implements the idea that you shall not eat other humans. All right? What's being spoken of in Genesis 9 isn't the law of murder, it's the law of cannibalism that's being reflected. Murder is already built into the DNA of human beings. They already know that it's wrong to kill another human. How do I know that? Because later in this story, Cain is going to justify what he did. He knows it's wrong to have killed his brother. The law of murder is already embedded in the DNA of human beings. What we see in Genesis 9 is the prohibition against cannibalism. The story moves on. Verse 3. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. All right, now let's stop for a moment. Notice that these two men come before God to bring an offering. They come to bring an offering because that's what they were taught to do. How did they know to bring an offering to God? Why would they come with an offering? Because they had been taught. I am absolutely convinced that Adam and Eve instructed their children on what it would mean to approach the Creator. How do you come before a holy God as a people now who have been banished from the Garden of Eden? We no longer have direct access to God by virtue of walking in the garden where He walked with us. How do we have a relationship with this Creator? I'm absolutely convinced that Adam and Eve would have taught their children, you need to bring before the Lord an offering just like God Himself had made for us. This is Adam and Eve speaking. So Cain and Abel come and bring their offering because that's what their parents had instructed them to do. You will notice that sacrifice before the Creator is established long before the Mosaic Law ever shows up, before it's ever codified. Now, let me also deal with what I think is also a bit of mythology here. The initial assumption that we often make here, that the offering by Cain is unacceptable simply because it's a food offering, is a bit simplistic. Yes, it is true, ultimately, that Cain should bring a blood sacrifice. But it's too simplistic to simply say, well, Cain was rejected because he brought a food offering. Here's why I say that. In the law itself, in the Mosaic law, God Himself will institute a number of grain offerings that He will demand of His people to bring. There will be a number of times that God will say, bring your thank offering and bring it to the temple, bring your grain, bring the first fruit of your crops, and bring it to me and wave it before me and give it to me, and I will accept it as a thank offering from you. So it's a bit simplistic just to say, well, it was a food offering unacceptable to God. No, food offerings can be acceptable to God. We must probe here for a bit deeper understanding of why it is that Cain's sacrifice would not have been acceptable. So we need to probe a bit here into the right circumstances, which leads then to God's response. Verse 4, part B. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. God's reaction is brought. Why does God reject Cain's sacrifice but accept Abel's? All right, that's the question I probed a moment ago, right? Now, again, as I said, the quick answer that we often give here is because Cain doesn't bring up blood sacrifice. He only brings a grain offering. Now, I accept the premise that, yes, Cain needed to bring a blood offering, but I want you to think about something here. There's a deeper reason why this grain offering that Cain brings is unacceptable and why a blood sacrifice is acceptable. There's a deeper meaning, and I want you to step back and think about Genesis 3 and 4 here. And the deeper meaning of this goes like this. Cain brings a sacrifice of death. Abel brings a sacrifice of life. There you go. What? Okay, think about it for a second. Cain brings a sacrifice of death. Cain, as a farmer, has to toil and sweat and work the ground in order to grow the crop, right? That was the curse that God put upon him. He took upon himself the noble task of attempting to feed his family like his father before him. And so he has to sweat and he has to toil and he has to plow and all the other things that he has to do and pray for the rain and whatever else is needed to make this happen. He has to toil, and the result of the toil, what is the result of the toil? The result of the toil is that it will literally send him back to the ground from which he came. The toil that man has to do to grow his own food, even to survive, will be the very instrument that will drive him back to the dust from which he came. The scratching and clawing and toiling and sweating that you need to do in order to grow a decent crop in order to survive will literally drive you into the ground. Cain brings the fruit of his toil, which leads to death. He brings an offering unto God, which comes from the fact that he is working and toiling, and all of his toil will eventually make it so that his body will fall back to the dust of the ground and die. He brings the produce of toil that leads to death. You hear what I just said? He brings the produce of a toil that leads to nothing but death. You could make the very good argument even that the grain in the basket as he brought it is itself dead. The reason why Cain's sacrifice is rejected is because it is the produce of death. I've used this example before. This also comes out of the early parts of the book of Genesis, right? Go back to the beginning of Genesis chapter 2. It says that God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. We call that a Sabbath day. And God instituted from that one day out of seven that the human race is to set down its implements of toil in order to rest. In other words, the Sabbath day is a day in which human beings are to set down the implements of toil that leads to death and do the work that leads to life. One day out of seven, God says, put down your implements that are designed to drive you right back into the dust of the ground and come and rest in my presence and do a different kind of work. The kind of work that you are to do is a work that brings life, worship, prayer, meditating upon the Word of God, fellowshipping with other believers, gathering together with the people of God is a toil, but it's not a toil that we have to sweat at. It is a toil that leads to rest. Even Jesus himself said, my yoke is light and my burden is light, right? Come and I will give you rest. I will give you what? Rest. Let me put it like this. The man who this morning decided to skip church in order to go to the office has decided that it's more important to do the toil that leads to death than to do the toil that leads to life. Abel brings a sacrifice of life. Abel brings an animal, a source of life, something that is inherently alive in itself, that lives without the toil and sweat that is not, well, I realize shepherds toil and sweat too, but the animal itself lives. It possesses a life in it. And when Abel brings it, God can take the life of the animal and impute it to the offerer, that the offerer lives. Just in exactly the same way that God did to Adam and Eve in the garden, robing them in the robes of the animal and giving them life so that they wouldn't fall over dead. That is precisely what Abel's sacrifice would bring. There's no such life in the grain offering that Cain brought, because all that he brought was the fruit of that which leads to death, not to life. No such life exists in the food Cain brings. And so God then speaks to Cain. Here's Cain's response, I should say, the end of verse 5. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. What was his reaction? He was angry, and he was disappointed. His face fell. Right? Disappointment. Why is he angry and disappointed? He's angry and disappointed because he had worked hard to produce this offering. Do you understand that? He comes before God with something that he's been scratching at the ground and toiling and sweating to produce, and he brings it to the Lord and he says, "Look, look what I have brought you. Aren't I wonderful? Look what I have brought. You should accept it. You should take it from my hands." And he is disappointed because God does not accept it on Cain's terms. You see, although God is perfectly within his rights to dictate the terms of entry into his presence, Cain is angered that God rejects his terms of approach. This, my friends, is the fundamental point of what Jude is bringing up in Jude 11. Cain is angered that God rejects his terms, Cain's terms. God is perfectly within his rights, is he not, to decide how any human being should come into his presence. But yet we, as fallen creatures, think that we get to dictate the terms. And so he is angry and disappointed because he has worked hard to bring an offering and God rejects it. And so God speaks to him. Verse 6, he says, "Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen?" It's a rhetorical question. Okay? God knows the reason why Cain is angry. He's addressing the point. "If you do well, will you not be accepted?" Now, again, that's a rhetorical question. It's the point that he's making is very simple. Do what's right, I'll accept it. Okay? That should just go without saying. But nonetheless, he says it to Cain. If you do what's right, will you not be accepted? What should Cain have done at this moment? What should Cain have done at this very moment? And the answer is simple, friends. He should have gone to his brother, Abel, and said, "Can I have a sheep from your flock that I can offer to the Lord? Can you give me one of your sheep?" How would have Abel responded to that? How would have Abel responded to that? Abel would have said, "Yes, take one. Anyone you want, pick one." You know why? Because that's why I'm growing them. That's why I'm tending them. That's why they're there. I'm absolutely convinced that Abel would have said, "Yes, absolutely, take one of these sheep. Go to the Lord. Because that's why I've been raising them." Remember I said earlier, we're not eating them at this point. Why are they there? Why does Abel have a flock of sheep? Because just as his brother Cain scratched and toiled at the earth in order to provide the food for his family to survive, Abel is working to raise up that which allows human beings to come into the presence of God, the sheep, the life that would be necessary. Just as God had made provision for Adam and Eve in the garden to have life, Abel was providing that which would be necessary for Cain and everybody else in his family to have life. All Cain would have had to do was go to his brother and ask. But notice what God says next. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, or a better way to put that is something to the effect of against you or over you. Its desire is against you, but you must rule over it. God says to Cain, there is a temptation standing before you, a decision at this moment that you must choose to make. And the temptation is this. You are being tempted to a permanent brokenness with me. But you must rule over that temptation. This would have meant something to Cain. Because Cain is a man who has been spending his life trying to take dominion over something. And what is he trying to take dominion over? The ground, the earth. He's trying to take dominion over the earth to grow food. He's sweating and toiling and doing whatever he can to grow those crops. He understands the idea of taking dominion over something. He must now do that here. He must take dominion over the temptation that is coming to him. He must overcome his pride in thinking that he gets to dictate what a creation, what a relationship with the Creator looks like. He must overcome the pride that he has in his soul of thinking, I get to dictate the terms. He must say, nope, I don't get to dictate the terms. I must master that pride and I must come before God and build a relationship with him on his terms. Failure to do so means eternal brokenness. He must take dominion. He must, in fact, obey the creation mandate of Genesis 1, 27 and 28. Which leads then to verses 8 and 9. We know how this story turns out, don't we? Every once in a while, as I'm reading through Genesis, it is the favorite book of the Bible for me. I spend a lot of time in this book, as you know. Every once in a while, you notice something you hadn't noticed before. This was one of those weeks. I noticed something I hadn't seen before. Read verse 8 carefully. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And there's a little footnote at the bottom that says that certain manuscripts, most of the best manuscripts, add, let us go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Where did Cain kill his brother? He killed his brother in the very place that he scratched and clawed and toiled to bring forth food from the ground. Now that I had never noticed before. It's ironical, isn't it? He takes Abel, his brother, out to the place where he himself is attempting to take dominion over the earth, and he takes dominion over his brother's life instead, and spills his brother's blood into the very ground that he's been trying to grow crops from. Isn't that fascinating? But that leads me to the ultimate question of this passage. Why does Cain kill his brother? Why does Cain kill his brother? Who is Cain angry with? Who's he angry with? Is he angry with Cain, with Abel? Has Abel done anything against him that would cause him to be upset? As I said a moment ago, I think Abel would have more than happily given him a sheep. Just come, I'll give you one, no problem. There's no hint in this text anywhere that Abel has done anything against his brother. But Cain strikes at Abel and kills him. Why? If his anger is with God, why strike down Abel? Now, interestingly enough, John, the apostle, in 1 John 3:12, actually asks and answers that question. Why does Cain kill his brother? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother's were righteous. But what does that mean? What does that mean? Here's why Cain kills his brother. Think about this for a minute. Abel represents the image of God. Doesn't he? His brother is made in the image of God. Now, so is he. But he sees his brother. And his hatred of God is focused on someone who represents that image. Cain strikes back at God. I see God in him, and I hate God. Therefore, ergo, I hate him. I hate him because he represents God. I see God in him. Cain strikes back at God for refusing to accept him, that is, Cain, as God. Remember the primordial temptation that came to Eve in the garden. You shall be like God. Satan came to her and said, if you eat from the tree, you will be like God. That's the primordial temptation. And it's exactly what Cain was dealing with. I want to be God. The terms of relationship between Yahweh and me will be based on my terms, not his. I want to be like God. And that man represents God to me, and I hate him. I hate him because I hate God. You remember that Hebrews 11:4 lists Abel as the first member of the Faith Hall of Fame, right? Very first member listed is Abel. Abel, it says, has a relationship with God, that Abel possesses a righteousness because it is based on faith in the promises of God. What Cain sees in his brother that he despises more than anything else is the fact that Cain has a relationship with the Creator. He can go to God, and God loves him. And Cain comes to God and says, I want you to love me, but I want you to love me on my terms. Love me on my terms. And he kills his brother because his brother represents all that he himself cannot produce. All that he himself cannot produce is what he hates. So now let's go back to Jude 11. That's enough of the story. Let's go back to Jude 11. What is the point that Jude is attempting to make when he says that these men walk in the way of Cain? Now, it's interesting, by the way, that Jude writes it in the past tense, for they walked. Past tense, in the way of Cain. But I think that's just simply a way of saying that they have already made a decision to something, okay? The false teachers have walked in the way of Cain, meaning they also have fallen under the dangerous belief that we get to dictate the terms of what it means to approach a holy God. Very simple. Very simple. Cain believed that he could come to God and dictate the terms. Accept my grain offering. I know it's the toil of death, and I know it's dead itself, and you can't impute any life in me, but that doesn't matter. I want a relationship with you on my terms. He believed that his sacrifice was perfectly fine, should be acceptable. He was looking for the happiness that comes for being accepted on his own terms. You see, the false teachers pervert the gospel of grace by teaching that we can come to God by any means or any life we desire. That's what the false teachers want you to believe. They want you to believe that you can approach a holy God, you can approach the God of glory any way that you want to, and, more importantly, that God is obligated to accept our offering and make us happy. The false teachers say, you know what? The terms are not God's to set. We set the terms. Come into the presence of God with whatever life you want. Doesn't matter whether you have a life that is good or not. Doesn't matter. Just bring to God whatever. And he is obligated to accept it. See, we can even go so far as to ignore the sacrifice that he has made for us and bring our own. I tell you, my friends, this is the essence of religion, found everywhere on this planet, of men deciding how they will approach God. They ignore the true sacrifice that Christ has made and come with their bowl of dead fruit unto God. And the false teachers attempting to permeate the Christian church are attempting to bring the same thing. So here's the point that he's making to us. He says, like Cain, we must take dominion over the tendency to diminish that which God demands of us on his terms in favor of our personal desire to just be happy. Is it because of the human race, but the Christian church in many ways, the human race in general, but the Christian church in specific now, what we see particularly in our day is the idea that, well, what I really want from God is for God to make me happy. So I should be able to just come into his presence with whatever I want to offer, and happiness becomes my goal, and therefore he is obligated to make me happy. He's obligated to take my worthless life and make me happy in it. Remove the pain and the suffering and the difficulties and the trials and the tribute. Take them away so that I can have a wonderful life. Right? That's coming to God on our terms. It's to walk in the way of Cain. See, unlike Cain, we need to remember that God demands self-denial, discipline, discipleship, and the pursuit of holiness as our living sacrifice. Romans 12:1. We offer our bodies as a living sacrifice to the Lord. We come not on our terms, but on his terms. We don't come looking that we might have happiness in our wretched lives of pursuing after materialism and power and prestige and whatever else we're pursuing in this world, and assuming then that while we're doing that, God is just looking at us going, isn't he wonderful? I'm accepting all that he's doing. That's to walk in the way of Cain. It is extremely dangerous for the teacher in the Christian church to stand and say, God just wants you to be happy. No, our God demands that we must deny ourselves and take up our cross and follow Christ. That we must deny our happiness in order to pursue holiness. We must not bring the sacrifice of death that we toil to make, as though somehow God will accept it. But we must bring the sacrifice of life that he has given to us as his free gift of grace by faith in the Lamb of God. There is one who has come down, and he hasn't killed an animal. He's killed himself. He's lived a perfect and holy and sinless life, and he has gone to a cross and shed his blood in order that you and I aren't going to be covered by the skins of animals, but to be covered by the righteous robes of his holiness. That is the sacrifice of life. Let us not be caught walking in the way of Cain and bringing the sacrifice of death. Our toil that leads to our demise.